And knowing that college students don't like to be led, I assume there's at least 3 or 4 groups already formed, right? Okay. Why don't we take, if you have groups already, why don't you get your names in order, okay?
I'll get this thing started over here. And we'll see if we can form it to, well, at least,
I don't know how many groups we'll end up with. If we had 40 students, we should have 10 groups, right? So why don't those of you who have already formed groups, put your names down and the subject matter you're going to cover. Okay, put a little box in there so I know who's with what group. Okay. In the meantime, I'm going to put some things on the board here for you to think about, and it'll give you an idea of what our term paper might involve. Okay, so you'll have some idea what to look for. And so, form your groups in about 15 minutes, okay? While I write on the board. Penn Convention in October 1956. And he's originally from the interior. He's half Basque. And he was also the, I don't know, some of the books have it wrong. He wasn't the first president of the statewide Native organization called. At first we called it the AFNA, Alaska Federation of Native Associations, when we first formed it in October. Well, 2 or 3 months later, there was a little coup d'etat, and they dumped us, and he became president of the AFN. Actually, Flory Lekanoff, who is now used, was the first president of the Alaska Federation Native Association when we organized it in Anchorage in 1966. But that time, Emil was president of the Cook Inlet Native Association, which hosted that first meeting. And he was a very important person that we could rally around back at that time. And I think he'll be an interesting person to listen to. He also headed up the Alaska Native Foundation that put together this book. So we'll see now what he thinks of what has been created. That he was a part of, and see what he feels has transpired since the settlement occurred. Who knows, he might have something newsworthy to say. He might think that it was the most drastic thing that ever happened. I don't know, really, deep down, you know, what he thinks about what happened today. And also I had talked to Byron Malott, who is from Yakutat. And he and I are trying to get on together on a date. I gave him 2 options when he might come to this class. I think Dennis has been talking to him about a luncheon as well, but in any case, I want somebody from Southeast who's familiar with their history, their political history, as well as their perhaps some of their early contact history. We want to know why they didn't drive him out. I don't know. Frankly, I've never asked the question. Is anybody a Tlingit here? No Tlingits here? Good. Well, you won't get attacked. We won't charge you for it. Okay. Before we start into the subject matter today, I kind of wanted to bring something to you that's sort of happening right now. And some of you remember the topic before last. We described something of what's been happening and what the consequences of that Settlement Act war and the kind of confusion that has existed in the minds of the Native people, a problem of identity, and the workings of the educational system, and trying to fit the concept of a private corporation
onto people who were hunters and fishermen and gatherers.
And the effect of the religious teaching
on the people. What does that produce in a rather concentrated period of time?
Well, we're trying to deal with that. Just right this last week, after I left this class, I went up to Kotzebue. And there we have what we call an elders' conference. And we started these elders' conferences in 76. So this is our fifth one. And most of the people are somewhere between 55 and 85. And they come from scattered villages along the Kobuk and up the coast, Kivalina and Noatak. And so what they do is they get together, and they are sort of, they develop an agenda about a whole variety of subject matter, generally dealing with ancient times. They dissect animals, you know, verbally, and they name all the parts of all these animals and the uses to which they were put. And this is all, of course, videotaped and taped for use by the people of that area. They also describe warfare, or they might describe marriage and divorce, or they might describe hunting methods, or they might describe the making of certain types of implements, or they might describe survival methods. One of the and they divide into groups, and they have different people report to the whole group. And for instance, one of the reports dealt with how they created drinking water in the dead of winter. And you're probably curious how they did. So anyway, they did. One of the ways they did was they carried intestines, say, of certain types of animals, maybe seals, which had been cleaned out. Oh, and in this one case, they also carried a flipper of a seal, you know, which had been cleaned out and stuffed with water and snow and tied adjacent to the body, you know, as they were moving about. And they also used intestines that they wrapped around their bodies and loaded the snow and pushed them out to produce potable water. And on occasion, they would, if they got caught out, say, in the ice without any matches, they described how they would use the ignition, the igniting, you know, of a shot in the chamber as a means of starting a fire by, they had gasoline especially, and start a fire that way. And anyway, in other times they would, in olden times they would, they had a kind of a mechanism, kind of like a top, right, that they used to pull back and forth to create real high speed, you know, to create friction and make some fire. Then they make a fire, say, right on the lake, where there was fresh water, things of that sort. In any case, the key thing we were trying to do, though, had nothing to do with all this fantastic knowledge that at this day and age is not being transferred. Consciousness is not working for us. What we're trying to do, in effect, something that you might want to ask some of our speakers that come later on, is we are trying to transfer power from some of us youngsters. And you might ask, well, what are they trying to do that for? What do they know about business? These people are, you know, mostly non-literate, a lot of them. They have only a bare working knowledge of English. Some of them maybe almost, you know, just a minimum one. And they know nothing about balance sheets or income statements or proxies or
annual reports, anything. So what are we trying to do? And why?
Does anybody have it? Is anybody curious? Or do you think it's even important?
You know, you have to kind of bring it down to reality, right? That's why I'm here, I guess. But you know, it's one thing to
look at a book and try to understand the relevance of what happens in history, or you know, in times past.
One reason would be the influence and respect that these people would engender among the people in their community.
Could you say so again?
Well, I think one thing would be the respect that the elders would engender among the people of their community.
Why do you think that would be important?
Well, solidarity would be very important on specific issues of concerning the general populace.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a very important point for us. Because that is a very important point. Can anybody think of anything else? Solidarity and respect.
Well, you said giving the power to the old elders. If the youngsters are given power.
Well, let's put it this way. Maybe I'm making myself a little bit unclear. I'm not talking about complete power.
No. But sure. If an elder feels that we're being getting ripped off from ages past to today, they feel weak and they feel that there's nothing they can do. But if the youngsters show them that they do have power and they do have something that they can survive on and something that there is a future with, then maybe they could instill that into the other.
Okay, you just raised a question in my mind. Do you think the elders realize, do they know, have they been ripped off, or, you know, that's the term you use, really understand what has transpired in their lifetime?
Do they? Well, if they don't, maybe the purpose of your meetings is to show them.
Okay. Okay, did you have a... Yes.
If we're trying to incorporate traditional native values with the modern influence of the corporation and religion and everything else, then probably one of the places to start with the values is one of your most traditional, your most original sources, and that would be with the elders. And when you combine their values along with the power that you have, giving them, taking their values and letting them ask their advice on how, with their values, they would use these things.
Do you think that's important? I mean, he's talking about what is that something that a profit-making corporation has to deal with?
Not normally.
Not normally. That's true. It's not. I mean, how many corporations do we have functioning today that gathers together their senior citizens to tell them how to do it, right? Okay. Well, you see the uniqueness of what we have here.
And along with that, is that it just depends on which direction they want to go.
Who's they?
The corporation.
The corporation. Well,
if you want,
you know, normally a corporation represents investors, right?
Right.
I mean, people who have shares, and generally they're interested in some dividends, right? I mean, that's that appreciation in their value of their stock, as well as dividends every year as much as possible, right?
But there's some other way of looking at a corporation.
Yeah, well, this is indeed a unique type of a corporation. Any other observations?
Sure. Yeah? Corporations are vehicles not only of income, I from what I see, but also as a transfer to maintain cultural heritage and a lot of different things to keep.
Generally, you do a non-profit corporation or something like that, right? Some educational and medial monetary function of some type, do good. You know, generally, it's a tax dollar, right? it's a tax deductible deal where you give your money. And generally, just like Bob Abbott, right? He forms a corporation to a nonprofit education corporation to fund his wife Evangeline's great historical works, right? Yeah.
So I'm talking about respecting elders. I don't find a lot of respect for elders nowadays.
Where do you come from?
Up here. I have seen them come up in front of a potlatch and talk to everybody else, and they'll start talking about corporations and the way it used to be, and people will sit there and ignore them totally. And they've lost a lot of their spirit that you talked about. They are broken people, a lot of them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen people just walk away from them while they're talking.
Okay, now you're getting a little of the drift of what the subject matter, and maybe people might have been a little bit confused about what I was trying to say, in some of the media, some of the press that came out after the AFN convention, and after a little interview here and there, because I agree with you. There is the spirit of the people has been basically been driven, down. I mean, there is and this is what I was hoping that we could bring out in terms of all this vast amount of change that's transpired, which, has taken place over a significant period of time, in our class discussions here, but we're talking about an accelerated amount of new ideas and new happenings, and new controls of one kind or another that are now descending upon the people. And Alaska in general feels it, but it's, I think, particularly felt in these villages. The degree of control that people have over their lives has changed substantially. At one point, the control was sort of environmental. Before, there was a lot of influx of new people and new ideas and new laws. But at least it was something that they were accustomed to. The degree of control that was brought upon the person and his family and the group was natural. Right? It was the environment. They had to learn to live with that. And of course, in the meantime, things have changed. So this, I made my first speech in Inupiaq, and of course it was a shock for some people because they see me as a kind of a acculturated and somewhat assimilated. And it's been 25 years, since I left home to learn the American way, right? And so they almost had heart attacks there in this group, when all of a sudden here comes the businessman and politician speaking his own language. Well, it's so rare. I mean, for somebody new, like as young as I am, to try to convey the occurrences of the present and what at least I might foresee in the future in their own language, in an understandable, simple fashion. And what I was trying to tell them, of course, is that sort of in a very short, 20-minute talk, to try to tell them why we did what we did. Because many of them, I think, to this day, don't understand it, right? I mean, it's that bad. So maybe as time goes on, I will kind of bring you up to date on what we're trying to do. But I'm not sure if it's going to work or not. See, because things are moving along right now where we've been putting a frenetic amount of energy into business. And what? Are the people interested in that? I say that they're really not. They're interested in their land, yes. And they're interested in the continued use and occupation of that land that they've been accustomed to using for millennia. And of course, when you look at it, in the present day, there's a lot of terrible things happening, isn't there?
In villages,
and among the native people. I mean, you take almost every statistic, things are worse. I mean, there are more suicides, there's more welfare, they are worse off economically now than they were 10 years ago. Tell me something that's happening that's better now. Well, I don't see any hands raising. I mean, isn't it better now where you're from? Where are you from? Oh, no wonder you're not saying anything. Well, White Mountain used to be a very...
Well, the school system, you know,
it has improved?
Yeah.
They sent you here, didn't they?
No.
I mean, you came from there. See, so it has improved, right? I mean, before we got none from White Mountain. Okay, anything else? Housing's improved?
Yeah, the housing's
improved. Yeah, okay.
Material.
Yeah, material things have improved so much, right?
Yeah, I mean, to me, well, I haven't seen any elements. There's hardly any more church.
Hardly any more church?
Yeah. We have personally, that's...
Oh, it's an improvement. Oh,
well,
now that's a new record.
Well, that's my
boy, tell me more. Okay. Okay. Let me tell you, you know, what we did in 66 was we kind of, us young guys, just kind of got to the point where, I mean, we could see a little bit. I mean, like, we could see things that people who lived there couldn't see. I mean, they hadn't, you know, they were just kind of living their life, you know, letting the system, somebody else's system, kind of move in. And I don't think they were mad about it. They just didn't understand what was happening. Only on certain incidences of I would say surveying of land, and, you know, kind of mishandling of land, and people maybe not getting the land or keeping the land that they had occupied and stuff like that. But see, there wasn't a heck of a lot of movement with respect to, say, land transfers, except where town sites were surveyed. And even then there was some pokey-pokey going on. But the people were just kind of living their lives like they've been for a long time, you know, doing the best they can to survive. But in the meantime, of course, starting at the turn of the century, you know, we had the government's hand moving in, sort of in the form of missionaries and schools, and teachers and Indian agents, and government ranger handlers, or Office of Education. And of course they began to kind of turn the screws a little bit on their traditional ways, right? I mean, if you, and generally the people follow the law, so so they began to be affected by this other way. And let me tell you a little story. Somebody was going to do something on religion, but we had one missionary came to Kotzebue at the turn of the century, and you know, came up there, and of course the perception of the people in the villages was that these people were simple-minded people, kind of friendly, but they had to be taught the most elementary things about learning how to sweep, even to chop wood, you know. They made a big deal out of that. But we gave him an axe, and gee, within a short matter of time he was learning how to use it, you know. And so in the missionary, at first he thought the Eskimo dances were pretty fantastic, you know. They were just having a good time all the time. And anyway, this the note out, anybody here from Yorktown?
Anyway, the note out me, people who are from right up here.
Right up here, the only village on the North Hack. They used to kind of float between North Hack and Solis right here, where they come to get beluga and fish in the summer. But they were fairly nomadic. And so the church really couldn't really nail them down, right, to the church grounds. And so they'd have to kind of hustle out there to kind of check out their soul. Anyway, they had this kind of a feast, right, at the Kalvi, up in a place called Napaktuktuk, across there. And it was a joyous occasion. There were visitors, you know. And they did this wolf dance. And in the dimly lit Kalvi, you know, you can't really see. And this missionary just got scared, and he thought it was, you know, it was kind of like a spiritual deal, you know, because the wolf, his eyes were moving and everything, and they did all these things, and so he decreed that there would be no dancing. And he they had converts all up and down the pool. And so, for 40 years, the dancing quit. 1930, 40 years, and up and down the Kuba. And even in Kotzebue, because it was simple. And so, anyway, it was finally regenerated starting in 1938. This old Eskimo named Avanet, he's quite old now. He wrote a book called, you know, Paul Green, I Am Eskimo, Avanet My Name. Never read his book yet, I have to, but anyway, Paul says it was his father and uncle, two uncles that were in that region, that dance, you know, where the missionary decided to stop the dance. And so 38 years later or thereabouts, Paul, you know, he had the spirit, right? I mean, he was, you know, been there 10,000 years, so he had to, kind of let it out. So he and Okeliak, who is a guy named Abraham Lincoln, who was his first cousin, I guess, they decided to try to rejuvenate it. Well, of course, by that time, 1938, they had quite a few years of, you know, teaching, religious teaching. So it took a little nerve, right, to start getting going on this work of the devil again. So he him and Okeliak got together, and they didn't even have a drum. So they went down to Paul Davidovich's place. He was kind of like a Russian trader or something who had married my grandmother's sister. And so he said, I have a drum, you can use mine, but you have to dance at my bar, right? So he was going to make a go-off deal. So they danced at Davidovich's bar. Of course, that was kind of not a very nice place. So I guess Paul decided to try to move it to some more holy location, I guess. So he wrote a letter to Juno and got permission to use the school. So even then, one of the strong converted Eskimo ladies named Molly Berman, she was about this wide, we used to pull her around when I was a kid. She couldn't walk, she was so heavy, we had to pull her on this cart. Her husband was a trader named Tom Berman. He said, she went up to the principal and says, why are you letting Paul, you know, use the school to dance? He said, well, I can't do anything about it. He's got a letter from my boss. Anyway, Paul and them, in order to do the dance, they had to even build their own drum. They didn't even have it. They had to use real heavy rubber from the CAA, the Civil Aeronautics. You know, they send these balloons up to check the weather. They got some real thick balloons, but they didn't have any walrus stomach or something else to make the drum. So that shows how strong ideas are and the mind is, how people can affect how other people think. We had one of our participants in our old folks conference, when he came down a couple of years ago, he got kind of carried away when they were having the Eskimo dance. He's from upriver. He started dancing. Well, he didn't come back the next year.
And he came back finally.
We found out that he had spent a year repenting because he felt that he had sinned. So, and that's sort of the environment in which we are trying to function. We, the young people, I assume that they have allowed us to lead, hoping for the best, right? That we would not do something drastically wrong. But in reality, we have sort of tried to function without the benefit of their knowledge and wisdom. So what we're trying to do is ask them to consider advising us on a more formal basis. Like, we have a 23-person board of directors for our merged village and region and board. We don't have village corporations. In our region, it's like a tribal corporation in a sense. So everything is, instead of being divided throughout their ways, it's all in one group, both the land and the businesses. So we have a huge board, and you know, in the absence of a tribal government, which would be the traditional way of the Americans dealing with the natives, or the Indians, we have no government, see, to be responsible for arranging the method by which we function. And even then, what we do have in the corporation is deals with a rather minuscule aspect of life. This is, you know, nobody likes to balance their checkbook, do they? You know, I mean, it's just something that's kind of a, you know, and you need economics to survive, but you know, having to live for that purpose isn't exactly the greatest way to live. So what we're doing is we've asked the elders to provide a forum through which we can go and ask for advice, particularly in the area of leadership. Why would that be important? This is purely informal, right? This is outside the normal channels of corporate activity. The board of directors selects the director, or whoever is interested goes and attempts to solicit proxies to get enough votes to see themselves as a dissident candidate, say, for a board. In this instance, we're asking them to look at that person in that village and pass on their qualifications. So what do you think they'll be looking for in a person?
Leadership?
Well, spiritual? Yeah. What else?
More traditional.
Traditional?
Values?
Business? Well, as a matter of fact, a little bit of all of that. But of course, in a way, we're going to attempt to elevate the status, right, of being a board member. And this person is going to be somewhat scrutinized for a certain set of values. And because, you know, we're reaching a stage, or going to be reaching a stage, where the utmost confidence has to be placed in your leadership, in the board of directors. Because in effect, you're holding in trust, you know, your ancestral land, and the future of that. part of it. And so that person will have a more responsible view of what this function is, and perhaps feel that they should pay more attention to what is going on. And because, you know, we're dealing in a, you know, when you're dealing in business, you're dealing in an area of substantial responsibility. And in our case, that's all we've got. I mean, our land and the values up in the land and the enterprises that we operate, you know, in a competitive world, you know, you have to have a substantial group that are working with that operation. So look at the Russian American company. They had the whole, they had the blessings of government, and they had shareholders who were the nobility in the court. In this case, of course, we're all shareholders in the company. The difficulty is, though, as you have seen historically, is that, you know, if the government couldn't get what they want, you know, through the real leadership, they'd go through some dissidents, somebody who may not have the real responsibility, who may not be strong in character. So what we are attempting to do, of course, is try to ensure that those people who hold these board positions understand the degree of responsibility they have, and the elders passing on that, I think, will be a
okay. People and board members have this responsibility, but I also think that they also should tell everybody, every shareholder, the responsibility, because the act says that as of 1991, you can sell your claim.
Okay, well, that's part of it, and that this is just the beginning of what we're trying to do. But we have, it's just the very beginning. But the other thing is, though, let me tell you what how it might work. Now, I don't know. the board takes all kinds of abuse, and the management, you know, for everything that's going wrong in the world, right? I mean, prices are high, nobody gets jobs. I mean, there's, you know, they're attacking our hunting and fishing rights. You know, there's all kinds of things we have to deal with. Not necessarily strictly involved in the business of life that we operate. And so what we're going to do is, and sometimes you get in a situation where certain shareholders might be asking for something special, right? You know, some special concern over certain pieces of land or something, or maybe taking of timber, say, on corporate lands that belong to everybody. The development of our land policies and things. so what we're going to do is we're going to have like a Supreme Court, right, of elders. So if you have a gripe, you know, and you come to the board and you raise holy hell and you don't think it's one, right, then we make our decision. If you don't like it, well, you can go up to the elders, because, I mean, they have nothing, no special interest, right? It's for the good of the group. And they'll make the determination as to whether we are right or wrong. That's just kind of a start. What are you reading?
Are these elders being selected, or
Well, we're just kind of working out the mechanism. And let me tell you something else, you feminists. Try this on for size, you see.
in the old days, and that's not, I mean, this is within their lifetime, when it comes down to surviving, no, that's generally primarily man's responsibility.
And so we had, when we met the,
and asked the elders if they would be willing to consider taking on this role, they talked about it for a couple of days. It's not as if they just said, oh, yeah, nothing to do. I mean, that's not the way, I think. But the women, they were off meeting in, you know, in different groups and stuff, and the men were contemplating this issue. But when it came down to a vote, they were all there, the women all conceded that when it comes to survival, that it's a responsibility of the men to deal with.
Is that
what? Yeah. Well, I don't know. Whenever they, when the men had discussed it, and they came to some conclusion, the women unanimously voted with them. So it's not that that in our region we don't. You know, to me, the existence, the continued existence of some feminist type group means to me that, you know, we haven't dealt with the issue, right? The problem. There should not have to be. And in our board, we probably have, I don't know, maybe 30% or more of our board that's, and we don't have enough people, frankly. Right? You know, we've always tried to survive together. I thought I'd just bring that out just as an incident. But nevertheless, they all voted unanimously to take that responsibility, and was asked if there was any disagreement that somebody should speak up at that point. So that was a big move. I mean, for us, that's a real significant move forward, because you know what we're going to do next is we're going to work through the. With bilingual aides in the school system. And we're going to have them work with each community in the organization of their local elders conference, or elders council in each of our 11 villages. And out of that group, we will get the wisest people to give us a hand. Yeah, okay. It's just happening in our region right now. But you see, it has to, you know, the problem varies from area to area. And although I've had a couple different sessions with some of the leadership, the key leadership from different regions. You know, it's not that easy of a problem to focus on for them because a lot of people don't understand their functions, their role. I mean, if you assume, like we talked about the other day, if you assume that your only function is to make dollars, right? You get to make, to analyze investments, to operate them profitably, and to keep your clientele happy, if that's the way you view your function, then all this other stuff's not going to really be attended to unless there's some other institution that's going to take on the responsibility of people survival, right? Life survival, language and identity. And some regions are desperately fighting to stay alive economically, right? So they're all, in fact, let me tell you this story. This last week, when I went to Anchorage for this meeting, I left the elders conference, as a matter of fact, just to go to this other meeting. Very small one, you guys. Wondering, you know, what we're doing and how we're trying to deal with it. And this one young guy, he reminded me of me when I was younger. Yeah.
He's the chairman of his region. He's younger than I am. And he said, Willie, he said, I got it. When I saw you in the newspapers talking about the spirit and the language and the identity and the traditions of
our people, I got a little angry about it. He says, because
the previous group that was in power was so busy trying to do something for shareholders, the business was going to hell. And so I come along and now I'm trying to build it up so that we won't lose it all because we're not making enough profits. And they're going to glom on to your ideas and they're going to run me out of office and we're going to be in deep trouble.
Of course, I don't know what he meant when he said they were just trying to do something for shareholders, but I assume it wasn't from the standpoint of trying to preserve them as a group, that is, you know, trying to maintain their traditions and language.
You know, it all varies, you know, as we go through this class and we go through the different the different impacts that have descended upon different parts of the state, you know, you'll begin to see that when you look at some native person's eyes, right, and behind them comes a different kind of a history, right? I mean, there have been impressions and influences, ideas being transferred from generation to generation, which makes up the people they are today. And some have a very, very strong sense of identity. Some fairly dissipated. And who's to say what's right for them to do? Maybe for certain groups, just engaging in business, trying to help them find a place in society where they can survive economically is the primary function. So they use their corporate power to generate businesses that employ them, or where they could use their corporate influence to have their associates hire them. And you know, from that sense, they might have a strong identity with the corporation. Maybe that does not have a lot to do with their nativity, whatever tribe they might have belonged to. Of course, in some groups, you have a real mixed situation, where you have a whole variety of Tlinkits, you know, Eskimos, values, where there's not really any real tribal cohesiveness. And so what they do in a situation like that might be a little different. How many regions do we have represented here? How many shareholders?
Cook Inlet? Anybody from Cook Inlet?
Goyan? Arctic Slope? Crystal Bay? Crystal Bay?
Port Village?
Twin Hills?
How about Nana? Come on, put them up there. How about any other region? Otna? Otna? We have some people from Otna here?
From where?
You're from Otna?
Yeah.
You last? Anybody else?
No.
13th region?
That's all native.
I see, you're from Chile.
Bering
Strait. Oh, Bering Strait?
Yeah.
There's hope. At least you got lots of spirit. by the way, I did find, I have a whole slug of annual reports from different regions that I brought up to the Demert collection, I guess it's called. Some, just last year, some go all the way back, you know, to the beginnings of the companies, and it's not that, it's pretty easy to read these annual reports if you know what you're looking for. It gives you some sense of what they've been trying to do, at least on a business sense, you know. And you can maybe look through them to see what, if any, sort of tribal consciousness they might have showing through. Right? Some, they're all different. Some, you look at them and you think that they were any other American enterprise, you know. And others are heavily people-oriented, tribal-oriented, despite the fact that they're engaged in a whole variety of enterprises. So, of course, you know, what we're trying to do with the elders is kind of an element of what's going to happen, you know, if what we're trying to do works. Because the idea, of course, is to take as a focal point not the corporation. Right? We're not, that is not the focal point. It's sort of the individual and the group, the communities and the tribe, and the sense of continuity and of identity and of spirit. Okay? Just in case you don't understand that. So there's a, when you're talking about a spirit, it's kind of a, you know, it describes a kind of sort of a, so kind of an attitude or a consciousness or a way, you know, that people are and think and do, right? I suppose certain communities have a kind of a spirit. I don't know how to describe the Anka Fairbanks spirit. Who represents the Fairbanks spirit here? You know, and this is what I'm speaking about. When I'm talking about the spirit, it's kind of a sense of being that you know that people have a certain way, a certain outlook. And consequently, you know, at least in my mind, when I talk about the Inupiaq spirit, it has something to do with how people view the world and how they treat each other and kind of a sense of responsibility. You know, that generally is expressed through the language. See? And so if you get the drift of what we're trying to do, that focus on our people should infect or affect all the institutions that we deal with, right? Whether it's the school system or the corporation or our nonprofit. So one of the main considerations that is going to determine our successes naturally, the very institution through which you have emerged. I hope, unscathed, that is the school system. Because when we're dealing with a educational system, we're talking about the implanting of ideas in people's minds that is going to affect them throughout their life. And at this stage, part of our idea is to take the elders, and they will begin to do their share after all these years of not. Okay. But what we have had is a kind of a diminishing of that spirit. And a kind of a, what I call a discontinuity of spirit, kind of a breaking down of this feeling of belonging. And which is generally expressed through language. And also the interaction with the environment. Because, young people are very impressionable. And you remember the whole sense of smell and touch, and sound as you're growing up. So what we're going to try to do is have those older people hired by the school system, right? I mean, what the hell has somebody from Chicago got to teach our kids, that's the most to do with this person's eventual identity. Of course, if that person from Chicago is a fantastic English instructor or a fantastic mathematician, fine, well, we need them, but we're going to first at least have this child know who he is, right? He has to have a sense of himself. And so we're going to try to do that through the elders, as well as not the old, not real old, some of their parents as well. Because at this stage, we're producing a world of children who don't know who they are. There's an inability to communicate because there's no transfer of traditions. There's no transfer of values. There's no transfer of history or of language. And we're putting them into a system where it's quite different from theirs. It's a competitive system that rewards you for excellence. It's an individualistic type of thing, whereas where I think most village people are, where we come from anyway, there's a tendency to go with the group, for somebody not to get too far ahead of the flock. They're kind of pushing back because it's always been group survival, right? And you share whatever you got. And so this other system is just just the opposite. And but we know that we can't withdraw from the world, can we? In fact, we can't put up a China wall at this stage. And so we have to, like I tried to explain, we have to go both ways. Okay? And we're going to, I don't know if it's going to work, because we're basically dealing with an institution that isn't ours. The school system is belongs to the state. Right? Supposed to be belongs to the state. Somebody have a question? Yes, sir.
How is the tradition of the school? Could you give an example of how it would be expressed in a profit-making corporation?
In a profit-making corporation? He wants to know how that would be, how it might appear
in a profit corporation.
Okay? Yes.
Well, do you want me to answer that first, or is it related?
Well, it's related to that. Southeastern has a place where they make meat and stuff like that. They do some like copper. They have some crazy corporations that is funded, I think, by the state, but they make a lot of money off of their cultural flavor. And the Indians have a lot of spiritual pride in that, and they, you know, gain a lot of pride in the fact that they can sell it and they make money, and the state makes them out of the free school.
Okay. Question is,
how do you, how does the question of spirit and
tribal identity and tradition, how does that emerge in a corporate structure? Okay.
Well, the only reason I'm interested in this is because of that very necessity.
In fact, it will eventually affect how we manage our corporation and how we run it. Okay? Let me tell you why. I think I gave one example already. That is that, you know, in any kind of a structure, an institution, especially in a corporation, you have to have the confidence of the people below you. And presumably in the American system, especially, it's kind of like the military, right? If I make an order, you know, in the company on a certain policy, you know, all those little boxes down there are supposed to fall in line, right? Otherwise, if they don't follow the company line, they're out the door. Okay. Matter of fact, it's a good thing you asked that, because my thinking about the spirit emerged in a sense because of economic considerations. Because I was thinking to myself now, how does a group make wise decisions? Especially if you're a hunter and a fisherman and a gatherer, and you don't know anything about the business world. So I thought, well, the first thing you have to do is you have to, as some wise person said, know thyself. Right? You have to know who you are and where you're going. So, in the context of these particular corporations, the question is, if you say, who are we? You generally say, well, I'm Nibat, I'm Italian. You know, I'm Clinkett or I'm Nally. Because that's what binds them, that's at least the one common denominator, that they are, in effect, tribal people. So, if you start from that point, then when you're developing your corporate philosophy, that's going to emerge, right? I mean, if you take the view that while Congress created a business out of you, you don't necessarily have to end it there. Right? You have obligations to your shareholders who happen to be your tribesmen. So what we have done in our corporate philosophy, which maybe someday I'll bring to you, we developed it years ago, in effect just now beginning to implement it. The profit motive is down to number 4. Right? And the development of our people, that is the continuity of our people, the development of pride, the building up of our communities, you know, they take their first. Right? And so, from an investment standpoint, how that affects a corporation is that, if you're going to be involved in the building up of your people, then that's going to affect where you put your money, for instance.
We have spent some millions in Kotzebue in that area, okay?
If we say we want to try to bridge a gap between the old life and the new, we invested a lot of money in Ranger, because lots of our people like to be out in the country. It's not a huge step, you know, from being a hunter and whatnot to, you know, at least you're out in the open. I mean, you're sort of confined to do certain functions, but then you're dealing with animals, you know, you're dealing with the weather, you know, you're dealing with the things you like to do. And from our standpoint, it's profitable. Right? And it employs a lot of people. And then we built a huge kind of a multi-purpose facility, which is part business, but it's also part cultural pride. And we have a huge museum that involves the animal life of the area that is kind of like, it's a mixture of high technology and, you know, it's a kind of a sound and light show that we do with this animal life that is part of our tour operation. So part of our program, of course, is to employ people. That means you have to invest in the region as much as you can. But you can't go overboard. Because generally, if you're trying to invest in outlying areas, you're dealing with a minimal market and high costs. And that's what we have. So generally, our operations in Kotzebue don't make a bundle. They employ people. And it tries to be a service. So if you're looking at it strictly as a business thing, and you're not concerned about your people, then you might invest elsewhere, completely outside your region. And some regions have done that. In fact, some people have their main offices in Anchorage. Well, in our instance, you know, our headquarters and the real power is in the region. And as far as I'm concerned, the real power will always be there. Because the way we look at it, from a purely economic standpoint, I am expendable in all my operations in Anchorage. So, in the case of the Alaska, they have a scholarship program that's designed to help along their young shareholders. They have what's called a Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation, which is designed to be culturally oriented, to work with the elderly. You see, I don't know what you think about that. You know, this is something that the shareholders of every group has to deal with. I mean, if they want their people to be just businessmen, then conceivably they won't take a major role in cultural affairs, right? The preservation of their people. But in our case,
you know, when our board met last time, we had a half a dozen young Turks reminded me of me again, right? Raising holy hell at our board, because the whole variety, you know, it was like kind of a little explosion, you know, like there was a lot of this repressed feeling that something was going right, and they came to our board to raise hell. Well, to me, that was a great sign. That meant they were ready for it. And if we had tried to move out of the purely economic area, I'm sure we'd have got slapped down. They'd say, hey, what are you doing trying to preserve our language and all this sort of thing? You're supposed to be over here making some dollars for us. But in reality, they're coming down and saying, God, everything's so bad, somebody's got to do something. Well, they're coming to the group that I think, you know, can begin to tie it together if we take it from the perspective that our board of directors, our 23 people, is not just a board of directors for a business, it's like a tribal council. Okay? So that is just part of the way that our corporation might function, if that is the will of the shareholders, and we'll find out when we meet in March.
Yeah. What is success for a corporation?
What is success? Okay, that's a very good question.
Because you know, the traditional measurement of a business, of course, is profit. Okay.
When the Russian American company started losing profits, they sold Alaska. Right? But it depends on the group. And in fact, you might ask the same question of the Settlement Act itself. You know, what is success? Right? Conceivably, Bering Straits could lose everything and still succeed, right? Depending on what they view as their goal. I mean, maybe their goal is to maintain their identity and their language and their traditions and their history and develop themselves without outside help. And maybe at this stage, it's still not a big loss, because if you lost all your economic power, all you have left is your land and your identity. Well, isn't that all that many Indian tribes have? I mean, they got no money. Okay. Okay. So maybe they will start from scratch. Right? They got a lot of scratch. If they recognize that, then they may have success. Well, in another instance, you might have a corporation that hits oil or something like that. And all of a sudden they're rolling around in Cadillac outboard motors and smoke machines. And you know, there's money flying out of their pockets, and you know, they got three-story igloos, and you know, they all got Super Cubs. They're flying around all over the Arctic. But of course, if they don't survive as people, is that success? You know, if they're disintegrating, and the language is going, and that these human connections of the tribe are flying apart, is that successful? Depends on your measurement. Well, we'll take a break.
Sometimes it takes a lot to survive in this society.
Okay. Do you have any comments or questions on this little topic we kind of run through? I wanted to kind of discuss that a little bit, because we're dealing with a very fluid environment right now. And this is sort of one example of how one region is trying to deal with all the currents, you know, of change, of new responsibilities, and really new challenges. And in a way, I don't suspect it's much different than what some of the older Indian tribes attempted to try to do, you know, back 140 or 50 years ago, is it? if a group has to survive, they have to do it however they can. And some of those groups, of course, they went to war to try to maintain their sense of identity and place in the world and everything else. And of course, they were defeated, some obliterated. Other groups possibly ended up in the mountains somewhere. When Seminoles ended up out in the water, and the where is it? Where is it? Never say, yeah. and adapted to a life among the snakes and alligators. And the Cherokees attempted to take on the trappings of the Western world. And that didn't work. Well, our problem is to try to survive as people, using the ultimate weapon of the civilization that is tended to destroy the corporations. As you know, the Russian American company was a corporation. Somewhat ruthless one at that.
In many respects, but
less ruthless than, say, the numerous private companies that began functioning in the 1740s and that went on to the 1790s. So you had a half a century there of unbridled economic exploitation by a variety of small companies that virtually enslaved the people of the illusions. And that was for profit.
For the bird, the sea otter, and the fur seal.
And of course, in Baranoff's tenure, it was maybe not as brutal, but nevertheless, there was an exchange there, presumably, of human labor for some economic value. And here we're trying to take the same instrument, corporation, and presumably improve lives. And if economic improvement is a great value, then we're going to try to do some of that. At this stage, we are improving life for you, pretty much, you know, because our people are geared into the 9-to-5 routine or 8-to-5 routine, highly specialized trades. Just yet, now we're developing that capability, but if you ask what the how the reflection of the spirit might emerge in the management of a corporation. Let me give you another example. Right now, it's important to have competent shareholder management. I mean, you don't run the corporation yourself, then you have to find a higher cut, don't you? It's just like a school system. You don't have your own people to run it, you have to go get somebody from Chicago who knows his stuff. Well, the management of corporations today, they're all over the place. And some have, out of sheer desperation, hired a top-notch managerial type who hopefully is going to save them from bankruptcy or at least losing money. And if that fellow runs it just as he would run any other corporation, he may not do things that are beneficial, right, to the people, the shareholders. You'll say, well, we better close the Bethel office. Right, we're losing a bundle over there. Maybe we should invest in that cannery where our shareholders sell their fish and work, because it's too dangerous. You know, it's not something we should be in. We better get into something different. Well,
know, if you if you have the spirit in the sense of your people, then you head to a corporation. It should take you down certain avenues, right? I mean, you may have numerous potential investments, from building a gambling house in Reno, you know, to acquiring a hotel in Lahaina, to investing in the Bahamas, right? So how do you know, if you've got the spirit, and if you got a sense of where your people are going, that'll, you know, a lot of the really outrageous potentials will fall by the wayside based on your criteria. And so also in the area of key native managers, shareholder managers, I mean, you know, you really got to be far gone to be controlled by a corporation, right, as an individual. I mean, to have to give yourself to an institution, particularly if you grew up in an environment where you were somewhat free, right, to enjoy your sense of being. I mean, Christ, having to kind of march to work every day and sit down in this cubicle, you know, and contend with phone calls coming back and forth, numerous people coming to and fro. I mean, it's a dog's life, right? And particularly when you could be enjoying the beautiful breezes, the wind whistling through the trees, you listen to the ducks, you know. I mean, that, you know, everything else pales, you know, beside that. But so, yet we have to take our people and gotta run this thing. Okay? And it's not exactly our cup of tea. But if we do it, because we have to make it work. And so, it will make a difference in terms of your management policy, see? I mean, if you really want to keep your clique, your value, managers, you've got to arrange it so it's possible for them to escape this madness. You know, you got this. Just because it's a corporation doesn't mean that you have to run it like they do. You know, you change your policy so that you get these people out of it when they need it, right? The right times of the year. Get back to the land and back to the people. And one of the things that's happened, of course, is that once you get into the economic arena, there's all kinds of temptations, you know, because our system sort of glorifies economic success. I mean, outrageously so. Huge watches with gold all over them, rings, you know, three-piece suits, cowboy boots, and, you know, masses of this and that. So it becomes tempting, doesn't it? And you realize that it's not really all that mysterious. Economic thing. Any dojo could do it. And you see all these opportunities. So you've got to take care of your people. I mean, the group, that is the board, has to, you know, it's got to be almost like a Japanese corporation. You know, where Mitsubishi, man, once you're rich, hell, you've been planning. You were this high, you know, your parents, right,
were married in the Mitsubishi chapel, and you are being groomed to go to a Mitsubishi kindergarten.
Really?
And if you're lucky, you'll get into Wright Mitsubishi High School, you know, where all the Mitsubishi guys go. And if you, you know, if you really work your little butt off, you'll end up going to the proper university where all the Mitsubishi guys go. And then when you get out, you will be a job waiting for you in Mitsubishi, and they will even bury you. Okay?
Well,
but you know, is this not true? Huh?
Thank you for saying that. As, you know, I didn't really know for sure.
But in any case, you know, there's a sense of belonging, right? I mean, it has, I think, something to do with the ancient Japanese culture, right? It has simply taken a new form. And consequently, that's all I talk about, insofar as what we have to do. We have to take our basic nature as people and try to adapt it. So, in terms of our management, I'd say we have to provide for that management so that they will not have to worry about the future. One of the consequences of the type of system we live in is that there is no security, is there? Right? That's why you're here. You're trying to cram enough in your head so that in your old age, you know, you'll be tottering around, but you're not going to be starving. You know, or Reagan won't be president in cutting off your aid. See? So, this is, in part, I think, part of the frenetic aspect of life in America. Yes, sir.
How is the spirit expressed in land use policy?
Land use policy? Okay. you're getting ahead of my plan. I haven't gone that far. However, what we're going to do is we've already gone through the process. Right? So what we did in our region was we had to kind of follow the rules that were set up in the act itself, in the regulations. And so what we did was we had the people of the community already involved in the land selection program. We didn't have a lot of time to do that just within the 2 years after the first 2 years of the passage of the act. So the people who had the greatest familiarity with the land have already been involved in the land selection program. Now, where it's going to matter in the future is in terms of the development of our own rules for the use of our 2.5 million acres or so. Because we're going to be under substantial pressure by individuals who, say, missed out on the allotment process, who didn't get any land, like me. So we will be presenting this to the older people, and they'll help us determine what is equitable. So we'll also be using them with respect to sort of more religious sites, right? Or important areas in our people's history, certain occurrences that may have transpired over time. That's how it will be reflected. At least my initial impression.
With talking about the spirit in the corporation, and you're talking about Mitsubishi a little bit, what if something happened with your own corporations? What if one of them all of a sudden took off, started selling widgets to Japan, and all of a sudden was on the New York Stock Exchange?
Yes, yes, yes.
And what you basically got is a little group consciousness of small mm-hmm. corporations, and you were talking about your people's group, mm-hmm. attitude of nobody gets ahead too much. But what if one of your corporations all of a sudden had the chance to provide for the security, to really go for it, and show all the people that, you know, you really could do a profit-making corporation like nobody ever saw? What would happen if something like that?
Well, you see, I think, in my opinion, this is a concept that is applicable, you know, I mean, in American society. Because basically, as we were talking during the break here, this process that we're going through, all these what people call problems, that our villagers are going through, it's nothing new, is it? And it's been happening to Americans since the beginning. Because people came from everywhere. And disorientation, I'd like to have a little study done, you know, what happened to the Irish when they came here. They probably drank like they haven't stopped yet, right?
The Irish in here?
Yeah, right? Right? I mean, see, I mean, the disorientation and the disconnection between individuals and their heritage, you know, is a process that has been ongoing. And consequently, there is a difficulty in really managing this country, because there's a series of spirits, you know, of people who have come from the same country, who have kind of a sense of common happening in their life and in their past, and I don't know that much about what's happening down south now, but there was even a big convention in Chicago, Euro-ethnic, right? People from, the America is a conglomeration of people, and the Indian happened to be just already there. We already had a sense, had a sense of belonging and a continuity of identity over a long period of time, and there's not a lot that ever happens in America that grabs the mutual consciousness, is it? When you have something like the continent, everybody goes ape, right? It feels so good to finally be able to get together on some one thing, and that's something of that spirit I'm, you know, trying to talk about. But I think there are some companies that already exist that in effect have a profit motive, but also are sort of engaged in a